Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. The war in Ukraine appears to be escalating, even as Russian troops are withdrawing from some of the Ukrainian territories they've occupied. The U.S. and its Western allies are now talking about the war in terms of an outright military victory, as opposed to simply ending the conflict, which I and others have argued was precipitated, at least in part, by actions of the United States. The war has affected global oil prices and the availability of certain food commodities, yet the United States is spending billions of dollars in military aid with little to no debate in Congress, even as the U.S. economy is suffering and the national debt is reaching record levels. The war is choking the supply of grains to African nations affected by record droughts due to climate change, with Somalia in particular facing an actual famine. Yet our money is going for missiles for Ukraine, and the U.S. weapons manufacturers are doing quite well. It's been my thesis that the United States not only foresaw this conflict, but anticipated it gleefully, as it had the potential to accomplish a range of strategic goals. Weakening Russia was an obvious one. Russia is a powerful competitor, especially with regard to economic and political influence in Europe. Some have said that the war in Syria is, in some sense, a proxy war between the United States and Russia. Clearly, each imperial superpower seeks control. And by pushing NATO, the U.S. has been converting Baltic nations to client states steadily. The U.N. has released a statement opposing Russia's obviously fraudulent annexation of four provinces in eastern Ukraine, though in the early days of the conflict, Ukrainian President Zelensky seemed willing to give up a couple of those provinces as part of a negotiated settlement that would have included not seeking NATO membership. The U.N. statement conspicuously omitted Crimea, which the U.S. and now Zelensky are insisting be returned to Ukraine. Crimea voted to annex with Russia nearly a decade ago after Russia staged a military intervention there on the pretense of protecting Crimeans against attacks from white nationalist Ukrainian militias. The circumstances are very different than the current fraudulent annexations, and the issue of Crimea wasn't really on the table at the start of the conflict. It seems that the U.S. in particular has been pushing for Crimea's repatriation with Ukraine, and my feeling is that this is simply a plot to prolong the war, which Noam Chomsky described as a case of the U.S. being willing to fight Russia to the last Ukrainian. We've covered all of this in the last few months, but this week there will be an event in Columbus related to the issue that you won't want to miss. Code Pink co-founder Medea Benjamin will be speaking in Columbus as part of her book tour, promoting a book she has just published on the Ukrainian conflict. In today's show, we'll hear a long excerpt from a recent talk she gave elsewhere as part of the book tour.
In putting that together. And if you're not on that list, we recommend you get on that list because every 2 weeks we have a different issue around foreign policy that we look at and then have a discussion and then we take action because we are all about action. And that is why I'm doing this book tour because I don't know about you, but I'm pretty scared about the direction that this world is going right now. And it seems like we can go in two very different directions. One is a path towards nuclear war, which I know that we don't want to go there. And the other is a path where we figure out how to work at the negotiating table and make agreements and get along and then start working on the real issues that we have to address, which is the climate crisis, as well as issues like racism and how do we make our military, how do we shrink the military and put the funding into things we need? It's so sad in a college town like this where students have to fight to have the ability to go to college when I have seen in my lifetime so many other countries that are much poorer than the United States that not only have free education up into PhD, doctor, whatever you want to become, but a stipend so that you can live while you're getting your education because those societies understand that we need well-educated young people and it's in our interest as a society to provide them with those opportunities. So obviously we are a very backward nation. when it comes to taking care of the planet and its people. And we are a very backward nation when it comes to learning how to negotiate and talk. And when you look at the Department of State, it might as well be an appendage of the Pentagon. Because really, they don't do a negotiating. I mean, have you seen Secretary of State Tony Blinken negotiate with Lavrov or anybody that could help find a solution to the Ukraine crisis? Certainly not. And when it comes to funding, if you look at the funding for the State Department, we've spent about as much on Ukraine right now as the entire budget of the State Department. So we are very underdeveloped when it comes to peacemaking at a time when we so desperately need that. And it's interesting. I mean, I'm speaking to a group now, I'm assuming, because I know a number of you know that you probably understand that the Ukraine situation is extremely complicated and that certainly we have to fault Russia for this illegal invasion that goes against the Charter of the United Nations, the Kellogg-Briand Pact, and we have to fault Russia for the brutality of killing civilians and destroying civilian neighborhoods and schools and hospitals. But we also have to look at ourselves and our own government as having laid the framework, created the context, goaded the Russians into this terrible situation. And as I do this book tour, I will be in places where there will be a lot of opponents to this way of thinking, and I look forward to that because I think we need a lot more discussion in this country and a lot more interaction with people who don't think like we do. We don't have to go very far right now to find people who don't think like we do. And that is just about every member of Congress and certainly in the Democratic Party. And it's such a sad moment in history when you feel like, oh, we got Ayanna Pressley in Congress and we got the Squad and we have AOC and we have Rashida Tlaib and we have Ilhan Omar and rah-rah. And where are they when it comes to this? Where are they when it comes to just being rational? It's nothing radical. It's being rational about this issue and doing what the Pope just did, which is say we need to find a negotiated solution to this. But somehow in this atmosphere, when you have a Democrat in the White House, you have an election coming up, and you have a strong speaker in Nancy Pelosi who thinks maybe it's good to have a war with two large powers as she went to Taiwan to antagonize the Chinese. She is keeping her flock in the Democratic Party in line, and I think probably saying, we have an election coming up in November. We can't be seen as weak on the security issues because Democrats are always being labeled as weak on national security. And we don't want to be seen as a divisive Democratic Party. And so we need you to stay in line with us. And that's why we saw this just pretty unbelievable vote in Congress. It blew me away to see $40 billion. I mean, that's so much money. And to not have Barbara Lee stand up and say, war is not the answer, to not have Ayanna Pressley, to not have Jim McGovern, to not have, you know, anybody in the Democratic Party to stand up with a rational vote. And the only ones were some Republicans in both the House and the Senate. And Rand Paul, who was just asking for some transparency, saying, where is this money going to go? This is a hell of a lot of money. How do we know where it's going to go? Is something set up in place so that we will have some accountability for this money? And that was just pushed aside. You know, how dare you ask for accountability just because we got out of an Afghan war recently where we had no accountability for trillions of dollars that we wasted to let the Taliban come in and take over again? And it's interesting looking at some of the reasons that 57 Republicans voted against that. Now, you're always going to get this party politics going on. So when you have a Democrat in the White House, you're bound to have some Republicans who are protesting war, even though they tend to love wars and be even more hawkish than the Democrats are. But these 57 in the House and 11 in the Senate were all over the map when it came to their reasons for opposing the $40 million. For some of them, it was simply, I think, to get at Biden. For others of them, it was because we have domestic needs at home that need to be funded, something that we would, I think, agree with. Others had some ideas that we should be fighting the Chinese and not the Russians, or we should be going sending all this war equipment to the border of Mexico to secure our own borders. But in the Democratic Party, there was zero. And not only for that $40 billion that happened just now, last week, for the vote that went through on Friday, in which there was another $13 billion. And you didn't hear one Democrat stand up. And, you know, it's funny because they told us it was part of this continuing resolution to keep the government going, so we couldn't vote against it. And yet they put up a fight around Joe Manchin and the dirty energy pieces that were in that and got that taken out. So, you know, why couldn't they put up a fight and say this was a separate, we want to vote separately on the money for the Ukraine war, and they didn't do that. So it is interesting to see that so far the voices of elected officials that are speaking out about this are coming only from the Republican Party at this point, none from the Democrats. And yet the American people, even though they've been fed a constant diet of very one-sided war propaganda, they are starting to see through this, as we have seen in the poll that the Quincy Institute, which is an organization quite recent that came together with money from both the left and the right to say we have to find a way to demilitarize our foreign policy. And that poll came out and said that 57% of the American people want to see negotiations, even if it means a compromise with Russia. And, you know, I don't talk like this when I'm in a different crowd, but since we're among friends here, you really have to scratch your head and say, do the American people really care where the line in Donbass is going to be drawn? You know, is that something that is a national security issue for the United States? And yet, the way that this is being posed in the U.S. is that the defense of Ukraine is a national security issue for the United States. And it's also been very sad to see how the U.S. has helped to quash negotiations that started in the end of March, the beginning of April, and how the U.S. position of constantly throwing more money into this really creates a disincentive for Ukraine to negotiate, and how Zelensky himself, who had campaigned on a platform of peace and said that he was going to resolve the conflict in Donbas and wanted to see the Minsk Accords that were agreed upon in 2015 but were not implemented, that he wanted to see them implemented, not only did he get pushback from the extreme right in his own country who threatened his life, but from the United States and from the UK, who said they wanted to see this war taken to the end. The end meaning how many Ukrainians were going to die in this process, but also whereas Zelensky said at one point that he understood that the dream of entering NATO was just not going to happen, and that NATO was going to have to be a neutral country, has since really backtracked on that and is now saying that he wants fast track into NATO and that he wants to see Russia, every inch taken back by Ukraine, every inch of Donbas as well as Crimea, which is totally unrealistic. And we don't know what Russia wants at this point. I mean, the horrible thing of entering, starting this war, and then going up in the north and the east and the south and going towards Kyiv, and, you know, is Putin so isolated that he really thought that they were going to be welcomed like as liberators, and that they were going to be able to take over Kyiv immediately and put in a Russia-friendly government? It's hard to understand what his thinking was, and it's hard to understand what his thinking is now. But as we understand, we don't have the ability to put pressure on Putin. The international community can and should be putting more pressure on Putin, but we should be able to change our own government, and that's our responsibility. And when you see how difficult it is for us to even influence our progressives in government, you recognize how there is this tremendous disconnect between not only what the people are beginning to think, but what are our real needs in this country versus the 60-something billion dollars that we have already allocated for Ukraine. So it is interesting to see what are the voices that are speaking out on our side now. And certainly there are people like academics. There are the Noam Chomsky and even the realists who are not particularly progressives, like John Mersheimer, who I don't know if you've all seen some of his talks that have been marvelous, but I was shocked when I saw him saying about how China was the real adversary of the United States. So he is no peacenik. He's not in the same mindset, I think, as many of us here, but he has done a very good job of explaining the U.S. involvement in creating the context for this war. And then you also have one of the only places in the mainstream news where you can hear an alternative opinion is on Fox News, and is Tucker Carlson, who reaches millions of people. And while we probably disagree with him on a whole host of issues, when you hear him talking about Ukraine, you have to go, wow, you know, that makes sense. And I think there are a lot of conservatives who watch Fox News who are saying, wow, that makes sense. And he's not the only one. There are others on Fox News that are starting to come around to this position as well, including an anchor named Will Cain. And when I listened to what he's had to say, I was like, amazing, because his whole thing was, is the defense of Ukraine worth risking a nuclear apocalypse? And he's reaching millions and millions of Americans. I mean, there might be conservative people, but, you know, we need people to hear that message. And then, lo and behold, comes Donald Trump very recently. He's not allowed to tweet, so he didn't put it out on Twitter, but he did put it out in social media saying that this war needs to find a negotiated solution. It's a disaster for Ukraine and for the entire world. And then he put himself forward and said, maybe I could solve this problem. And he has also said that were he president, this wouldn't be happening. And I think a lot of people believe that, and I think it might be true, because I think he would have talked to Putin, whereas Biden is refusing to talk to Putin and makes it like, I'm so strong, I refuse to talk to Putin, whereas I do think that Trump would have jumped at the chance to try to negotiate this. So we also have Elon Musk. Did anybody see his latest entry into this? You didn't see that? Yeah. So he put forward his peace plan, which is great. And it is wonderful that somebody with so many millions of followers is also saying we need some rationality in this. In terms of peace plans, as we go into great detail in the book, the contours of a peace plan are known. There is certainly the Minsk Agreement itself, which deals with the Donbas region. There is issue about giving the Russian speakers the full rights that they deserve living in those areas. There's the issue of disarmament, which should include U.S. Armaments that are in Romania and in Poland and are a threat to Russia. And, of course, Russia returning at least to the position it was at before this war began. And there are good people to lead these mediations, and there have been some successful negotiations on specific issues, because one of the things you hear all the time is Putin is a monster, Putin is irrational, and you can't have negotiations with this guy. And we look to the areas where there have been negotiations already. I mean, first we could go outside of Ukraine and talk about negotiations that we've had on arms deals that Putin has been part of, and they have been agreed upon. We can talk about the Iran nuclear deal that the Russians were part of and signed off on. And then the U.S., of course, came back in under Trump and reneged on its deal. So you do have to ask, can you negotiate in good faith with the United States? But then in terms of Ukraine itself, we have the issue of the, I mean, who knew before this war began how important Ukraine and Russia were for feeding the world? And when folks realize that people in Africa and in parts of the Middle East, like Egypt, were going to have a tremendous increase in hunger because they couldn't get the grains out of Ukraine, this became an international issue. And so you had a mediation going on there that was very complicated to figure out how to create corridors, both land corridors as well as sea corridors, to get that grain out and out in the ports. And while it's not perfect, that has been done, and there are large amounts of shipments of grain that have been getting out of Ukraine right now. There's also the issue of fertilizers from Russia, and unfortunately, those fertilizers were under sanctions, and there was a deal made to lift the sanctions for the fertilizers because it was so important to the global food supply. The problem still remains about banks not wanting to deal with the Russians to be able to pay for those fertilizers, but there have been talks on that level as well. And then we have the issue of the Zaporizhia nuclear plant, where at one point it seemed like that was going to literally explode, where there was shelling going on, and both sides were accusing the others, and it was probably both sides that were doing the shelling. And there were negotiations, and the International Atomic Energy Agency came in and dealt and inspected that. They're sending more inspectors in, and at least for the meantime, that situation is a lot calmer than it was before the negotiations started. And then the other area is around prisoner swaps. And, you know, prisoner swaps are extremely delicate to deal with. The negotiations are very difficult in terms of who is going to be swapped for whom, how many people, how is it going to happen, how are they going to physically get out of one place into the other territory. And those have happened over a dozen times in these last 8 months. And so it does show that there are negotiations that are happening and that they could happen. So I think, you know, that leaves us to the point of talking about what is our job, where do we come in, and how do we start building back a peace movement that has totally fallen apart? I mean, some of us used to be very excited about the mobilizations where we could get, before the Iraq War, hundreds of thousands of people out into the street. Now I live in D.C., and around Ukraine, I must admit that we can't get more than about 20 or 30 people out to something. I mean, it is absolutely horrific what has happened to the peace movement. It fell apart under Obama. It became divided over Syria. Now it's totally divided over this issue of Ukraine. And I feel very convinced that this movement is going to build because it has to build because of the threat of nuclear war. But we are just extremely late in starting to build it. I don't know what the experience in Boston was in the early days of this war, but we started calling people out to say, you know, no war, stop this war, no to the Russian invasion, and no to NATO expansion. And we'd get out in front of the White House, and at those times, maybe we'd get 50, 60 people out, and those who were of Ukrainian descent had descended on Washington, and they were out there by, maybe 500 or 600, if not 1,000 people. And they were getting they were getting politicians like members of Congress to come out to their rallies. And at that point, they were calling for a no-fly zone. And they were really putting a lot of pressure on Congress for that no-fly zone. And you must say to Biden's credit that he did understand how dangerous it would be, and that would be lead into a direct war with Russia. And luckily, we didn't go that direction. But in those days, it was very hard to do any kind of protest because we would be overwhelmed by people with very convincing and heartbreaking testimonies about what was happening to their relatives and how we needed to be there to support them. I think these days we don't see those kind of mobilizations anymore. And, you know, maybe it's not yet the time where we think we can get significant numbers of people out. And that's why at this moment I think the most important thing we can do is education. And that's why we wrote the book. That's why we did this video. Don't have the video, don't have the book, but but we're trying. I feel like personally there's nothing more important that I can be doing is going around the country talking to people. Here in Massachusetts, and particularly in Boston, you are lucky to have an incredible organization, the Massachusetts Peace Action MAPA, that has done an amazing job. And I think one of the reasons why you have elected officials who are on the better side on some of these issues is because you have MAPA here and because you do put so much pressure on those elected officials. So you have Ayanna Pressley, that's one of the few, I think it's only one of 26 members of Congress that have signed on to a letter introduced by the head of the Progressive Caucus, Pramila, and then throws in this thing of, yes, we need some negotiation. And MAPA didn't support the letter. Code Pink didn't support the letter when they asked for organizational sign-ons. But we recognize that that's the best we're going to get from Congress right now, so let's try to get people to sign on to it. And I thought it was such a mild letter that all 100 members of the Progressive Caucus were just going to say, oh, of course. It doesn't say don't send any more weapons. And yet, it has been so difficult. It's been, I think, over a month that letter has been circulating now, about a month. More than a month. And they only got 26 members of Congress so far. So you got Ayanna Pressley, to your credit. Thank you very much. We haven't yet been able to get Jim McGovern on this letter, amazingly. A really funny story is that I've been going into Congress, which is not easy to get into anymore. You know, you might have seen a lot of pictures in the past of Code Pink getting into public hearings and jumping up on chairs and saying, stop the war. We can't get into them. Now the doors are closed. You have to have a member of congressional staff come down to escort you in. And then you're supposed to leave right after that meeting. And they say first their excuse was COVID, and then it was January 6th insurrection. And whatever it is, they can't even tell us what the reason. Oh, because once they told us when the mask mandate was over in Congress, then we could come in. But the mask mandate has been over for a long time now, and they still don't let us in. And it's so funny because we did a protest outside of Congress to say, let us in. This is the people's house. Let the people in. And there were Congress coming in. And when there were Democrats coming in, they were trying to run away from us as quickly as they could. I remember Mark Pocan, who is used to be the co-chair of the Progressive Caucus, very progressive member of Congress. We saw him coming up, and we ran up, Mark, oh, it's so great to see you. And we were filming everything, because we film everything. And we say, when are you going to let us back into the people's house? You're f***ing this, aren't you? You're trying to trap me into something, aren't you? And we were like, whoa, I didn't expect that. And when Republican Congress people would come in and say, when are we going to get back into Congress? And they said, as soon as we take over the House, it will be the people's house once again, and the doors will be open. So that it's hard to get into Congress. We got in a couple of times when we get meetings, and when we get the meetings, they don't literally escort you out. They trust you. And so, you know. Trust but verify. So they didn't verify. And we then start going to all the other offices that we can go to. And on this Ukraine thing, we had the letter printed out. And we stopped in all these different offices to say, you know, you really should sign on to this letter. We also stopped in one of the public hearings. I haven't been to a public hearing in almost 3 years. I mean, I used to live in that Congress. Our office for Code Pink was in the basement of the Rayburn Building in the cafeteria. That's where we met every single day. That's where we saw members of Congress, and we would hound them when they were getting their broccoli on their tray. You know, we would start talking to them. And now we can't go into these public hearings. So, you know, we say, when did the, what happened to the word public in public hearings? And so there was a door as we were going by, and it was open. It was to the old Foreign Affairs Committee that I used to love going in. So we just kind of peeked inside, and lo and behold, there was a hearing going on. And so we went inside and sat down, and it was one of these horrible hearings that they have, you know, witnesses that are both hawks on both sides. But it was so funny because they're not used to seeing any public come in anymore. And as soon as we came in, you could see them in the back whispering, like, and lo and behold, the police show up and say, what are you doing in this public hearing? You're not allowed to be in here. And they were the police who used to arrest us all the time. And so actually, when we got outside, they gave us big hugs and they say, we miss you. We can't wait till this place is open again. It's like a morgue in here. There's nothing going on. But we went over to the Senate side, and we went to have a meeting with Bernie Sanders' office. And it was a guy who works on foreign policy. It wasn't Matt Duss. It was another key foreign policy person for Bernie Sanders. And we sat down with him. We said, you know, I know this Pramila Jayapal letter is, you know, a good first step. And we need the same kind of letter on the Senate side. So who else but Bernie Sanders would you think of as introducing that letter? And he said to me, Medea, we think that letter is tone deaf. And I said, oh, so do we. You know, it's so great. We both think the same thing. It should say no more, freeze those weapon sales, no more. And he says, come on. We think it's tone deaf from the other side. We don't think this is the time to talk about negotiations. You can't negotiate with Putin. The Russians are not going to negotiate. And I'm like, am I in Bernie Sanders' office? You know, what is going on here? What has gotten into these people? And is it that they're just being told, wait until the elections and don't, you know, don't go there till after? Or do they really believe this? And we don't know, but we see these progressives who are going to Ukraine with the leadership of the Democratic Party, you know, the same people who were with us in the case of Iraq and talked about journalists being embedded and not being able to see anything when they went to Iraq. And here they're going and standing next to Zelensky with their arms around him in Ukraine. So getting back to this letter, they have kept it open because they really want to. They'll be embarrassed, I think, if they don't get. I got a message from someone else after you told me it hadn't been handed in yet, that they want to get at least 30 onto the letter before they hand it in. They're going to look so weak just having 30 members of Congress on that letter. But I think, you know, it's just indicative of how hawkish the Democrats are right now, how hawkish the entire government is right now, and how unable we are to address this crisis with the weak movement that we have. So we look to Western Mass, we look to the Boston area to give us inspiration on what we can do. And I'd like to turn it over to Cole and Brian to tell people what you are doing and what you need help doing. Thank you.
Medea, thank you for being here. I'd like to ask you to address the coup in 2014 and how NATO and the U.S. had a play in it, if that's true, and then also about the paramilitary groups that went there. And are they the instigators that are firing against Donetsk, the people in Donetsk, and they making it look like it was the Russians?
So in terms of the coup, you know, there was an uprising that I think was a genuine uprising against a corrupt, unpopular leader that was then seized upon by both the right as well as the U.S. and the West to say, aha, this is a moment to get out a leader who was pro-Russian and to put somebody in who was pro-Western. And so I think that movement got co-opted, and it did turn violent, and there were elements of neo-Nazi groups who were part of that violent turn of events. And there was also the U.S. involvement that we know from Victoria Nuland, who is based there, who was caught on tape talking to the U.S. ambassador about how who was going to be put into power once the pro-Western leader was overthrown. And I mean, the pro-Russian leader was overthrown. And that tape is evidence enough about how the U.S. had its hands all over this, as well as her going out into the square giving out donuts to people in the crowd. And I think that in years to come, when we can get these Freedom of Information Act documents, we're going to see a lot more about the hand of the United States in this, just like the U.S. has been so involved in other coups around the world. And, you know, it is quite ironic that the American public thinks that Russia interfered in our elections to get Trump to win, and yet most Americans probably do not want to admit the very, very strong role that the United States had in making sure that the coup happened, that Yanukovych was overthrown, and also making sure that the deal that his government was trying to make to not have it be a coup but a democratic transition, because they were talking about having a new round of elections, and how that was squashed as well. So the book goes into great detail, step by step, as to what happened during that uprising, what was the role of the neo-Nazis in this. And people also say, well, you know, the neo-Nazis are such a tiny percentage. They only got 2% of the vote in the elections. But that doesn't show how strong they are within the military. And yes, it was the Azov Brigade that incorporated a lot of those neo-Nazis that were the main fighters in Mariupol. Actually, some of the early prisoner swaps were for people from that battalion. But we do go into quite a lot of detail in our book about the role of the extreme right. And as I said earlier, I think one of the most pernicious roles of the extreme right was the threatening of Zelensky when he wanted to make the peace and forcing him to go along with them in choosing to not negotiate with the Russians.
They threatened to kill him, right?
Yeah. So, Brian, you had wanted to say something.
Hi, thanks so much for your talk. I had one quick question and one longer observation. The quick question is whether you have any observations about the explosion in the Baltic and the sabotage. But the longer observation is I'm struck when you talk about the position of the Republicans with parallels to the debate over COVID, because from the beginning of the whole COVID epidemic, there was an attempt on the official part to suppress efforts at alternative treatment and so just say, go home unless you can't breathe, and then until we get the vaccines. And oddly enough, since the Democrats were not sympathetic to this kind of break with the big pharma, which is a big source for them, they left it such that the doctors had the only platform they could find was with the Republicans. And so you had this perverse situation, just like you have Republicans opposing the big armaments to Ukraine. You had Republicans opposing the imposition of censorship against doctors. So I just wanted to make that observation and see what you thought about it. Thank you.
Well, as far as the Nord Stream pipeline, I find it quite incredible that so much of the mainstream media refuses to talk about in whose interest is it to see that sabotage happen. And it's certainly not in Russia's interest. I mean, Russia had no reason to blow up its own pipelines. It can and did just turn off the switch of the gas that was going through those pipelines. And then does the U.S. have a motive? Of course they do. Do the U.S. energy companies have a motive? Of course they do. Did we even hear Biden himself? I remember that press conference when he was with Olaf Scholz from Germany, and he said, if the Russians invade, there will be no Nord Stream 2 pipeline. And I thought, wow, that is so wild that he's saying that with the German guy.
When was it he said that?
He said this before the invasion, right before the invasion, yeah. And I thought, gosh, how could he say that? I mean, how could he say that the U.S. would make sure that there was no Nord Stream 2 pipeline? Well, lo and behold, I think the U.S. made sure that there's no Nord Stream 2 pipeline. So I'm pretty convinced. I don't know about the rest of you, but I'm pretty convinced. Brian, you say no?
No, I'm pretty convinced.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, and in terms of the other question, I mean, I think it's another example of how both parties pretty much are in the pockets of the big corporations, whether it's big pharma, big oil, big weapons companies, and that whoever's the one in power has an even closer relationship with those companies, and it allows for a little more leeway of those who are out of power to be advocating for more possible alternatives. So yes, I think there's an analogy to be made.
I have a quick question. Could you explain Hunter Biden's role in this? I mean, how did he get there and what happened to him? I mean, he disappeared from the news. And another quick question is, that civil war in Ukraine lasted 7 years. Was there any negotiations for peace within that 7 years?
Yeah. So Hunter Biden, I have no idea. I don't even know what happened to Hunter Biden. I mean, it's really an incredible mystery. But if the Republicans get in, we will have the Hunter Biden saga right on our front pages all over again. The issue of the Civil War, that is where the Minsk agreements came from. First, the first one and then the Minsk two. That was negotiated in 2015. And it actually was working quite well because the majority of the casualties happened in the very beginning of that civil war. And then the organization, the OSCE, the European Security Organization, came in with a large number of monitors, 1,300 of them, to monitor this situation, and they did a pretty amazing job. and they kept the statistics very clearly on the decrease in the amount of fighting that was going on until very, very close to the time of the Russian invasion, when it went up tremendously, and it was mainly coming from shelling from the Ukraine side into Donbass. But the monitoring of the Minsk Accord, I think, could be seen as quite successful. What wasn't successful is the political part of that Minsk Accord, because it was supposed to lead to autonomy for the region, and it was supposed to be that the leaders in Ukraine were going to meet with the leaders of the breakaway republics, and then there were going to be elections, and there was going to be autonomy. That part of it never happened. And then we go back to the right wing, and there, every time a leader, including then Zelensky when he came in, tried to make good on the political side of the Minsk Accords, they found opposition among the Ukrainian right. And the U.S. did not do anything to implement those accords either. But it is an example of you can reach an agreement and you can get outside monitors in. And were the political part successful, I think we might not be seeing this war right now. Probably wouldn't.
I just want to ask, where do you see China in all of this? Before the war in Ukraine, we were hearing a lot about the Quad. We were even hearing about...
You might want to explain the Quad.
Yeah, the Quad, a new alliance of the United States, Australia, Japan, and India. And we were also hearing about NATO even doing activity in the Pacific, which is absurd given what NATO stands for. But now with the war in Ukraine, it seems that the eye of the United States and its allies has been taken off of the Pacific somewhat and focused back on Eastern Europe. So what do you think China's opinion of all of this is, and what's their role diplomatically?
Well, China is really benefiting from this. And they have tried to not take a position, but they have been the main beneficiaries of the sanctions against Russia. They are getting oil at a tremendous discount, like a 30% discount. And that's because the Russians don't have a lot of options about where to sell their oil. And the Chinese don't want to get involved in the middle of this. There are many people who said in the beginning that China should be the mediator, that China had the ability to talk to both sides. And the Chinese, I think, felt that they were smart enough to stay away from that. And so they have refused to go along with the economic sanctions, but they don't want to directly stand up to the U.S. and the West either. And in terms of the U.S. taking its eye off of China, the U.S. military has not done that. They continue to see China as the number one adversary. We mentioned Nancy Pelosi going to Taiwan, and what a horrific move that is, but
yeah,
part of that whole thing of it continuing to be provocative against China. But the U.S. gets itself into these positions where it can't do what it wants, which is go after China, because it's stuck. You know, it was Obama that wanted to do the pivot to Asia, and he got stuck in the Middle East. And now it's Biden that wants to do the pivot to Asia, and he's stuck in his proxy war with Russia. So in that sense, I think China benefits in many different ways from this. We see the United States now squandering so much more of its money on the military and on Ukraine. The Chinese are spending a lot more money on their military as well, but it's a fraction of what the United States is spending, and they're continue to take their very smart policy towards the entire world, which is we want economic ties. This is about the Belt and Road Initiative. This is about trying to have win-win situations where we create these big infrastructure projects that might be terrible for the environment, but they tend to be things that leaders in other countries want to see happen. And they're out there making a lot of friends around the world while the United States is pouring its energy and money into an unwinnable war in Ukraine.
And Michael Hoey from the Zoom will be mad if I don't ask on his behalf what the role of the National Endowment for Democracy might have been in I assume he's asking about the Ukraine coup.
Endowment for Democracy has been years supporting groups inside Ukraine. It has always supported these color revolutions. It has always supported, quote, democracy building efforts, which is just so ironic because, you know, if there were other countries that were funding groups to overthrow the U.S. government in the U.S., we would definitely say that was illegal and that was not part of democracy building. But the U.S. was doing this in Ukraine, just as the U.S. is doing this with the National Endowment for Democracy in so many other countries, interfering, not only supporting think tanks and media organizations and all kinds of organizing, but precisely groups that want to overthrow the government. And NED's hands are very dirty when it comes to interference in the internal affairs of Ukraine.
Whoops. So I'm from Brazil, and a lot of my friends in Brazil from the left are saying, get NATO out, but they are not saying Russia out, because they still think that Russia still represents the Soviet Union and has the right to defend itself, and Ukraine is an enemy. So they say to me, you know, you say Russia out, NATO out, because you live in the belly of the beast, because you are all surrounded by liberals and progressives, and you forgot that what it means that that Ukraine has been used by the United States. And so they are provoking. Putin really didn't want to start this. And look at him. He didn't have any other option. And then they also say to me, and since Cuba is so precious to you, so look at Cuba now. And look what they are saying. They are not saying, you know, Russia out. Are they at least out loud enough? So I was asking people from Cuba, what are their points of view about the war in Ukraine? And some of them were vocal saying that Russia out as well. So what is your take about Cuba and this war in Ukraine?
Yeah, I think that some countries and individuals get caught up in a big contradiction when they talk about this war, because they want to talk about sovereignty and the rights to not be interfered with by outside forces, in which sense you would say the U.S. shouldn't be imposing a blockade on Cuba, Russia shouldn't be invading Ukraine. We should respect the territorial integrity of other countries. And I know a lot of Cubans who are against the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Maybe on the official level, they find it harder to say. But even when pressed, there are officials in the Cuban government who say that they don't think this was the right move. In terms of Brazil, it was really fascinating to listen to Bolsonaro's speech at the UN. Bolsonaro was very good when it came to Ukraine. Here you have this right-wing leader, and you'd think that he would be siding with the United States, because he does in so many other ways, and yet he came out saying that this war is a disaster. That this grain shortage is hurting our people, that we can't get the fertilizers in Brazil that we need, and that there has to be negotiations to end this war. So you're laughing, but, you know, it was interesting for me to hear somebody like Bolsonaro taking that stand. In terms of people who defend Russia's actions, I think we can say that as people who hate war, we can't defend any action that has brought so much destruction and continues to, you know, rain so much destruction on the people of Ukraine, and that I think Russia did have options and didn't use all of those options. I think that that he was terribly provoked, and we understand the provocations. We talked about the expansion of NATO. We talked about the 2014 coup. But there were provocations on a regular basis in terms of the U.S. putting in its missiles and moving its bases closer to the border. And I think as any peace-loving people, that we just have to say we're against war and we're against invading other countries. So I know it's not, you know, we don't all agree on this, and there are certainly people who support the Russians and think that they're only defending their own country and defending the Russian speakers inside of Donetsk. And I do think that it is important that people understand more how ethnic Russians and Russian speakers have been discriminated against in Ukraine in terms of their language, speaking their language in school, being able to have a free press in the Russian language. But I also think it's important to recognize that there are a lot of Russian speakers and ethnic Russians who are against this invasion and don't want to support the Russians who invaded and don't see themselves as being liberated.
Victor?
That was Medea Benjamin on the Ukraine conflict, speaking a couple of weeks ago as part of a national book tour. She'll be at Kerouac Cafe at the corner of Northwood and High this Saturday, October 15th at 6:30. This has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time in your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll be with you again next week for another edition. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.